Okay, thank you, Rihanna. Then let's turn over to the final topic of today. Again, we remain with Rihanna's team. We're going to talk about financial instruments with characteristics of equity. I give the floor to Angie.
Good morning, board members.
Oh, it's you, Gunther.
Good morning, board members. So to continue the fun of discussing financial instruments, we bring three agenda papers to discuss, and each of the three papers deals with three sets of disclosures the board discussed in February 2021. The staff plan to tee up and pose for the board discussion and vote on each paper separately if the board is happy with that arrangement. So agenda paper 5A sets out disclosures of key terms and conditions. The objective of the terms and conditions disclosure is to enable investors to understand the nature, amount, timing, and uncertainty of cash flows of financial instruments with characteristics of both debt and equity. It should also help convey the information about cash flows that are not representative of the classification as equity or financial liabilities. It should also help investors understand why particular instruments are classified as equity or financial liabilities despite those unrepresentative features. The key question raised at the February board meeting was about the scope of this disclosure. We think this disclosure should be made for financial instruments with characteristics of both debt and equity for the reasons explained in paragraphs 11 to 18. The scope will capture one, financial liabilities with equity-like features, two, equity instruments with financial debt-like features, and three, compound instruments. As set out in paragraphs 21 to 29, the staff recommend the board require the disclosure of key terms and conditions that influence the timing and amount of the cash flows on the instruments in ways that are not representative of their classification. As part of this disclosure, the staff recommend disclosure of voting rights only if such voting rights incentivize cash flows that are not representative of the classification of the financial instruments. In addition, as set out in paragraph 45 to 48, the staff recommend disclosures of the key terms and conditions that determine the classification of the financial instruments or components of compound instruments. And as part of the effort to alleviate the concerns around disclosure overload, the staff recommends scoping out standalone derivatives from the disclosure requirements for the reasons explained in paragraph 34 to 38. On the other hand, we do not recommend scoping out financial instruments with embedded derivative. As explained in paragraph 38, we think many equity-like and debt-like features arise from embedded derivative, and also the staff recommendation means that entities would not need to analyze the host instruments and embedded derivative separately for the purpose of making this disclosure. An entity would disclose the relevant features in the financial instrument as a whole, regardless of whether those features come from embedded derivative or the host contract. With that, I'll now turn the discussion over to board members before asking the board whether it agrees with the staff recommendation.
Okay, the floor is open. Sue?
Thanks, Uni, for the paper. I sent you through quite a lot of detailed sort of wording type comments on the paper, which I won't bore everybody with today, but so I'll just focus on the high level aspects. I broadly agree with what your proposals are in here, and I think that I agree with focusing on financial instruments which have, you know, are debt instruments that have got some features that you might not expect in a debt instrument because they're equity-like and vice versa. And I think all compound instruments. I think that's sort of the punchline of the scope at the end. That's where we pretty much end up. Just to flag, though, it does mean that we would end up with a situation where you could have quite structured liabilities in particular which have got features linked to commodity prices and stuff like that, where we wouldn't have specific terms and conditions, there would be information about those instruments by virtue of the existing requirements in IFRS 7, but they're much more aggregated and they're based on market risks at a more aggregated level. So it's a different approach. So I'm just flagging that. I think on balance it's okay, but it is a consequence of the proposed scope. I wasn't crazy about the wording that we end up with in the staff recommendations. I like the analysis and I agree pretty much with the analysis, but for example, if I look at 57B, I don't really know what information about the financial instruments characteristics, I don't know what the words really mean, that do not affect its classification as equity or financial liability. So I think what you actually focus in the paper, which is sort of saying what's a normal debt instrument, what's an ordinary share look like, and then if you've got a debt label or an equity label, but you've got features that are different to those, I like that idea, but I don't think the words we've got in 57B say that, so I wouldn't give those any sort of predominance in what we write, because I don't think they really say much at all. And similarly, 57C, I actually liked what you had in your examples in terms of the information that's provided, but I think these words in 57C where you say, you know, tell us why it's classified as a financial liability, people will say because there's obligations to pay cash, and that's very generic and that's not really what we want. I had a couple of suggestions on, you know, what we sort of list as a normal debt feature and what we list as a sort of normal equity features, just a couple of suggestions. Just so the board knows what sorts of comments I sent through to you as suggestions. I think it's not just that there's specified dates for debt instruments. I think it's more that there's fixed payment dates, because I think that if you've got a debt instrument which says you can either pay today or you can pay in 50 years' time, that would be a debt instrument and it's got a specified date, you know, you either have to pay today or in year 50, but that's not normal. So I think it's fixed payment dates rather than specified payment dates. And I think in the case of both the debt example and the equity example, we need something about ranking. I think a normal debt instrument is probably something senior and a normal equity instrument is probably the bottom. And I think it's good to bring those out. And also when I looked at your examples, I can see that you intend to focus on an uncertain feature of cash being the fact that there might not be cash at all because you get paid in the form of shares, but I'd bring that out explicitly rather than relying on somebody working out that that is an uncertainty of cash that you could get it in shares. But with those sort of wording suggestions, I agree with your overall approach. It's a good, I think you did a good job on a hard topic. Thank you.
Tom?
Yeah, so I agree with everything in the recommendations. I do have a concern, though, that it does rest on how we define debt-like and equity-like. And I did have a concern that the equity-like being simply unspecified timing and unspecified amounts is sufficient. I mean, normally we talk about equity as being some sort of a residual. And when I walked through the examples in 29, it seemed to me to apply equity-like, I needed in some cases, not all, to have some kind of residual notion to get to equity-like, that I wouldn't get there if I just walked through with unspecified amount and timing in my mind. You do need the unspecified amount and timing for some examples, but I think you need some kind of residual. So I would look at that and possibly, even as Sue said, just take another hard look, because this only works if equity-like and debt-like are reasonably clear at the end of the day.
Okay. Mary?
Thanks, Hans. Trying to build on Susan, Tom's comments, mine are, I think, like theirs, clarifications or refinements, because broadly supportive of both the recommendations and thankful for the work that you've done in making this as straightforward as possible. I had a similar concern when I read paragraph 45 to the one that Sue raised when she was looking at examples. Paragraph 45 says, here's an example of the type of boilerplate that people provide. We want something more. We want something different. But when I looked at the wording of what was proposed, I saw no reason that it would preclude responding in exactly the same way as the boilerplate example we gave in 45. So I think there will be a challenge for us in terms of how we write it to say, you know, so that the, how we write a requirement so that the answer is something other than because it does not require cash, you know, as the kind of punchline. A couple of other thoughts. When we are talking about, for example, on page 4 about rights, if we keep the word rights, I think I'm assuming that we want not just currently exercisable rights, but also contingent rights, rights that might be contingent on a future event. And so maybe we want to think about whether we use the word rights or whether we use the word terms, because I think terms might be a bit broader. I just want us to think about that. Alternatively, I think we just have to address the make it clear that it's the broader population that we're aiming for. And second, another comment, and this is just to check my understanding. In paragraph 20A, you say, considering the objective, the disclosure requirements would focus particularly on features that affect the nature, timing, or amount. If we say focus, that implies that there are other things that are additional to what is the focus. And I don't know if you really meant focus or if you meant would be limited to. And so I think that's just something we should be careful and considered in our language and maybe even spell out what we mean by that. And then when it came to the compound instruments, and for example, paragraph 33 in the paper, it wasn't entirely clear to me if you were saying have separate disclosures about separated components of a compound instrument, or if we thought it would be more useful to say, even if you separate components for the accounting, there should be a single integrated disclosure about the instrument that was issued, identifying what components have been separated out of that, and maybe even where they're classified. I have a feeling it's the latter, but I really, reading the paper, it just wasn't that clear to me. Two other things. In paragraph 36, when I look at your example for your discussion of derivative financial instruments, do you think that we would pick up as a disclosure requirement triggers or terms on which it would settle in shares, or would we just be saying disclose the fact that that's possible that it would settle in shares? So I'm just getting to how far would the disclosure requirement go about what the terms and conditions are. And then talked about paragraph 45, and I think that may be it. So I'd say my comments overall are about precision of the language that we're using, but broad agreement with the direction and objectives that you're setting out. Although some of them, they're more than just kind of drafting, their clarity about intent as well. Thank you.
Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. And thank the staff for the work done and the papers. In general, I support the staff's recommendation, but I would appreciate some work in the wording as proposed by Sue, Tom, and Mary just mentioned this one. I think that some clarifications would be very welcome. In relation to financial instruments that require judgment, in classification, your comment in the last sentence of paragraph 18, are you I'm not sure whether I thought that it was out, but the last sentence, it seems that you are proposing to address disclosure for this financial instrument that require judgment classification. You made clear that you would not do it for complex financial instrument in the last sentence of paragraph 16. I thought it, you would scope out also these financial instruments or criteria that require judgment. But when I read paragraph 57 and 58, it's not clear for me that these are out. If you can could clarify this one, just let me keep it going here, and then if you could clarify this one, I would appreciate. One point that I really like, and it helps very much, are the examples you included in paragraph 28 and 29. They are really helpful to understand the scope. I mean, that it's always good when we can get some practical view when we are discussing very hard, tough theoretical subject. And in paragraph 41 to 44, you stated the preference to limit the scope of the terms and conditions disclosures to those features that affect the cash flows of financial instruments. I agree with that. But in paragraph 44, you propose considering voting rights as a feature in the scope for disclosure if they directly affect the cash flows of the financial instruments. And then when I was reading the examples and trying to understand how it would happen, I'm wondering whether the assessment and conclusion on directly affecting the cash flows in some cases could be quite subjective and difficult to apply in practice. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tadeu. Rika.
Thank you, Hans. Thank you, staff. I think I support recommended by staff, I agree with what other board member already mentioned. I think first of all, especially for the liability like feature classified in equity information, those information we don't have a very good practice of the disclosure, even though there is some requirement in the IS-1, like paragraph 79 and 106, but it's heavily depending on the management judgment, what they are going to disclose and explain about those financial instruments. So I think this will be this direction provide a very good improvement in the disclosure in this area. So I think that will achieve the best balance of the investors' need and preparers' cost incurred. So limiting the scope is a really sensible solution, but at the same time, maybe the what other board member already mentioned that the preparers and the auditors will face some difficulty to ensure the completeness of the information to be included in the scope of this disclosure requirement. So we should carefully consider how we will refine the definition of the those financial instrument. Thank you.
Bruce, finally.
Thanks very much, Hans. Just to echo what some of the other staff said, some of the board members said, to start off with, thanks for the paper. I really like examples that help me visualize what's there. So thank you to the staff for that. My main comment is actually the same as today's. It was really around that kind of that paragraph 17, 18, around what we were putting in. I guess it was a twofold question. The first one was kind of what are we then saying we should do in a situation with financial instruments where judgment has been applied? Are we saying that that's not falling into this disclosure? Are we saying we wouldn't make them give anything? And then also kind of the same comment as he had really around the last line, just wasn't really sure what we were saying there, because to me, I mean, I would think that where financial instruments have been classified and there's been a lot of disclosure on those, that's something I would have expected would have been picked up quite a bit. So I have seen somebody said they'll comment on that. So it was pretty much along the same as today's. I also think that kind of reading through the paper, I see where we were going. Not that we're going to get into drafting, but I agree with some of the comments Sue said, just especially around kind of where we get to 57B. It was just getting into the wording and kind of in my mind expressing what we kind of summarized in all of that and whether it was really coming through properly. So I've also got some wording comments we can send through. We can look at the drafting. Overall, I did agree with the principle. It was just really around that paragraph 17 and 18. I probably would like to understand a bit more about what we're actually saying we would want there.
Okay. Next in line is Zach, but Uni, would you like to respond now to Mary and Tadeo?
Sure, yes. I think Bruce, you mentioned similar comments, so maybe I'll do that first. So in paragraph 17 to 18, we made such comment because we think that there are some financial instrument that doesn't necessarily require judgment in classifying them, but still have debt-like or equity-like features in them, which we think is beneficial for investors to understand those. So that's why we said what we said in the paragraph 17 to 18. And also, there was a mention about voting rights. So what we meant there is not we don't want voting rights to be disclosed when they are all linked to any cash flows, but we wanted voting right to be scoped in only when it is linked to the cash flows that are not representative of the typical liability or typical equity instruments. And just another comment Mary made about compound instrument, and you are right that we wanted the terms and conditions to be disclosed about the compound instrument as a whole, and how the equity-like features and equity component and debt-like features and debt component works for the instrument as a whole. And lastly, Mary asked about, in relation to paragraph 36, how far would we go in making companies describe the conditions that relate to share settlement, for example. So we think the share settlement feature could be mandatory or it could be discretionary, and you might have the right to settle in cash or shares, for example. So we want companies to describe whether that is mandatory or whether the company has a right or an obligation to settle in shares. So that's what we have in mind.
Okay. Thank you, Uni. Then Zach.
So I just wanted to say thank you to the staff. I think we've come a long way in terms of finding the right scope and in terms of also getting to a situation where the increasing risk and complexity of the instruments results in increasing complexity of disclosure, which I think is appropriate. This is a very difficult issue to get that at. And I think the staff have come up with some very elegant solutions. I support some redrafting to make sure the disclosures reflect that. But overall, I think the staff have done a great job on this. So just wanted to comment.
Sue, finally.
Yeah, just on this voting rights point, it's not obvious to me what exactly we're trying to get at here. And I think the words that we've got at the moment in the paragraph 44, which says the disclosure should be limited to cases in which voting rights are linked to the cash flows of the financial instrument. I mean, that's every default, you know, voting right. So I don't think that's what we mean. Then we've got one very specific example, which is where it's a voting right, which is an incentive to make somebody pay even though there's no contractual obligation. I can understand why that one is interesting, but I don't know how we articulate what we're trying to get at in a way that's going to, I feel like I'm being unduly critical. I'm not intending to be, but I feel like I haven't yet put my finger on what exactly it is about voting rights that we're interested in. Like what set of voting rights is it we're interested in that we want people to provide disclosure about? Because unless we can come up with that articulation, I'm not sure that we're not risking bringing every type of voting right in or nothing in because we're not really explaining what we're getting at. So I think there's a bit more work behind the scenes to do to try and really hone in on what it is about voting rights that we're particularly interested in.
Okay. Obviously, there have been quite a few recommendations to the staff, but given these, can we vote on the recommendations in paragraph 57, 58? Can I see who supports the staff's recommendations?
I'm voting for what I think we're aiming to achieve rather than the specific words.
Yes.
13.
Okay. Who will move on to paper 5B?
Yep, it's me still. So agenda paper 5B is about disclosures of financial instruments priority on liquidation of the entity. It's directed by the board, and in its February meeting, the staff had performed analysis of investors' information needs in this area and decided to recommend two separate disclosures to deal with two different categories of information needs. The first disclosure is on the capital structure of an entity, and the objective would be to improve the information about what makes up the entity's capital structure and the quality of the capital in each category within the structure. In order to determine what is part of an entity's capital structure, the staff recommend that an entity be required to include all financial liabilities and equity instrument used to fund or finance its overall business activities and operations. Staff recommend allowing entities to use its own judgment in how it disaggregates its capital structure and how it describes each category. But in order to help ensure meeting the disclosure objective, the staff recommends setting the minimum requirement as described in paragraph 16. That is, in disaggregating the capital structure, entities would be required to distinguish between secured and unsecured, subordinated and insubordinated, and issued and owed by parents and by subsidiaries. The second disclosure is on the priority of liquidation of particular instruments, and here the staff think the scope needs to be more targeted. Based on the analysis in paragraphs 27 to 34, the staff recommend the scope of this disclosure to be aligned with the scope of the terms and conditions disclosure discussed in agenda paper 5A. The staff believe that it will help capture the population of the instruments that are generally at the lower end of the distribution waterfall, as well as compound instruments. As set out in paragraphs 25 to 47, the staff recommend the board require an entity to disclose terms and conditions that indicate priority on liquidation, as well as those that could lead to a change in priority. We would like to highlight that we are not asking entities to analyze relative ranking of each financial instrument. Rather, the entity would be able to obtain those terms from the prospectus or term sheet. In addition, we recommend requiring entities to disclose if there are multiple levels of subordination within a category of financial instruments that the entity is making this disclosure for. If the board agrees with aligning the scope of this disclosure with the terms and conditions disclosure, we would expect entities to be grouping instruments with similar terms and conditions for the purpose of making this disclosure. Consistent with the board discussion in February 2021, we recommend disclosures of significant uncertainty about the application of relevant laws and regulation to the priority of financial instruments and details of the relevant intra-group arrangements such as guarantees. And also consistent with the board discussion in February, we recommend all quantitative disclosures relating to priority to be based on the carrying amounts. With that, I will now turn over the discussion to board members before asking the board whether it agrees with the staff recommendation.
Okay. Zach.
So, thanks again. In general, I agree with the proposals. I guess most of my comments are around the company's capital structure, and we're proposing to amend IASM. To present those. But reading through what we're actually discussing, with the exception of where the instruments are owned by parents and subsidiaries, virtually all that information struck me as things that really should be part of the basic balance sheet of an entity. And so I wanted to hear a little bit about the thinking on that. location versus somewhere in the notes. If the principle of disaggregation is looking at the capital structure itself, why would we do that in the notes? Why wouldn't the balance sheet disaggregate according to those principles? In terms of the other issues, and particularly the priority on liquidation, agreed with the proposals and really like, I think, where we've ended up. But was just hoping to hear a little bit more on the capital structure and why we would break that out versus sort of asking that it be a little bit more explicit on the face of the balance sheet, because it does seem critical to understanding the company, even at first glance.
Sue?
Uni looks frozen on my screen. I hope we haven't lost her. I'll turn my screen off. My comment was also on capital structure. So what I like in this paper and what I agree with is a sort of punchline in terms of the information that we are proposing be provided. And I like the idea of amalgamating the information about priority effectively with the terms and conditions proposals. I think that's quite a neat way of approaching the challenge that we left the staff to look at for us last time. So I like that. My concern is that given the importance of this, I think it's really important that we're all on the same page in terms of what the capital structure is. Can you hear me?
Yes, she can hear you.
Yeah, in terms of what the capital structure is. And I don't know what the words capital structure mean to, you know, all of the other board members, but it's not a defined term in our literature. And I think people have different ideas of what capital structure means. And I really, you know, I think this is an important disclosure. And so I think it's important that we are specific about what is encompassed in capital structure. I'm fine with management then making decisions about the best way to disaggregate it to provide useful information to people. But I think we should be prescriptive in the sense of saying, for example, it's not just equity. So don't tell me that as far as you're concerned, your capital is what's regulated as capital. I want it to be debt and equity. And also, I think one of the things that's making me focus on this is the discussions that we've been having at the Interpretations Committee about things like information about supply chain financing. I could imagine there might be some companies who would argue that they don't see supply chain financing as part of their capital structure. But I would say it was definitely something that was part of funding their overall business activities, but I don't really want to get into that debate. So I'm keen to be specific and very inclusive in terms of what's captured by the term capital structure to make sure we get a broad enough coverage of the funding of the organization included within the scope of the disclosures.
Jin Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Generally, I agree with the staff's recommendation, just some additional comments. Firstly, regarding to the capital structure disclosure, I generally agree with, but I think that with regard to the proposal developed in the paragraph 49A2, at a minimum, we would like to, you know, company to disclose those categorized information, for example, security, unsecured, contractual subordinated or subordinated financial instruments, or those issued or owned by the parent, or those issued or owned by the subsidiaries. First, I think maybe in reality, maybe different categories, there's some overlap, you know. So whether the company still needed to do all those information repeatedly. Secondly, if one company, one group, have more than 100 subsidiaries, and I wonder whether all those subsidiaries, the instrument issued or owned, should fully, you know, disclose or something like that. I think we should think about the how to operationalize those disclosure. So this is the first comment. Second comment in relation to the paragraph 49B2, agree with the B1 and three, but B2 we mentioned the disclosure requirements only related to when multiple subordination levels existing within a particular category. I think what we mean is not to disclose when. Actually, what we mean is to require company to disclose when multiple subordination levels existing, so that they need to disclose different levels of those subordination. Is it correct? I think if it's correct, I think it's better to clarify. Third comments on proposal paragraph 49C. I remember that when we discussed this relevant issue at the February meeting, we discussed whether those priority of liquidation information needed to provide on consolidation basis or individual entity basis. I remember maybe it should be, it's necessary to clarify. In my memory, in February meeting, we proposed to ask company to disclose those information on individual entity basis. If so, I have one concern because C mentioned that we are not only require those companies to disclose carrying amount of those instruments, but also need to disclose the line item those instruments are included. So if the liquidity-related information based on subsidiaries, but you know that those subsidiaries' financial statements will not be included in the consolidated financial statement of the group. So I'm not sure whether disclosing those line item, those instruments included, would be really workable or meaningful. So with regard to this suggestion, I think we should think about that. But this is exactly related to the disclosure basis, whether we should based on the consolidated basis or individual entity basis. That is the first area we need to clarify, because it seems that we are silent on this issue. Thank you.
Mary?
Thanks. I think I'm going to go back to capital structure, and Stu was expressing some concern about the squishiness of the phrase capital structure and whether we'd have to provide commentary about that. I was wondering, and this may be naivety on my part, about why we were using the phrase quality of capital structure as opposed to maybe less judgmental characteristics of capital structure. I just don't want to miss signal to people that we want a qualitative discussion from them about ratings or, I mean, it's not that we dislike that information, but what is it that we're trying to achieve? And I think it's something I would characterize more as characteristics of a capital structure. So maybe thinking about that to the point Zach focused on about who the issuer is in consolidated financial statements, I don't know that I would have expected to be able to see that from the face of a statement of financial position. I think that disaggregating is something I would have expected to look by issuer is something I would have expected more from supplemental note disclosure. I'm not against it, but that's just saying what my expectation is. And I think that the split you've proposed is correct in terms of parent versus all subsidiaries, rather than trying to get by individual subsidiary. I also on the disaggregation by whether it's secured or not, and thinking about that, this is very basic, but just give me a nod or shake of the head. I'm assuming that secured means that there's collateral attached to the instrument. Okay, you're saying yes. So I we don't seem to be talking at all about disclosures about what the collateral is, and I can't, and I have to admit to being lazy and not going back and researching current IFRS standard requirement to see if that's already required to be disclosed. Because we talk about disclosing the characteristics of the instrument, but there doesn't seem to be a need to disclose, you know, what assets are the subject of the security. Sorry, I should have said all these comments are in the context of tuning or refining the proposals rather than disagreement. In paragraph 29, you raise the applicability of the IS-1 disclosure requirements about rights, preferences, and restrictions. And if we think that they may not have been satisfied as fully as we would have expected from the current drafting, maybe one of the things we have to think about is whether we should move them from IS-1 into the disclosure requirements here, because if they really are applying to capital structure, to use that term, it may be better to have them all in one place and people may not be focusing as much on something that is in IS-1. I apologize, I am jumping around a bit here. On the disclosure guarantees, I am supportive of your proposals. There's kind of a statement of the obvious that I think it might be worth making, even though I think it's a statement of the obvious, which is when we talk about a requirement to disclose guarantees within a group, I would expect that requirement to come through even in consolidated financial statements, where some may look at that and say, oh, it doesn't matter, that disclosure requirement's not relevant because it's eliminated in consolidation. And I think what we are interested in having information that says if there's a problem in one of the things that's in the column of issued by subsidiary, that the parent has additional guarantees or obligations for that. So I think we have to make a statement of the obvious that it isn't considered wiped out by consolidation. And then the last is your thinking about you looked at and rejected, and I agree with the rejection, tying disclosure requirements to where a company is in terms of trouble or challenge, on the going concern spectrum. I agree with your analysis, but it did strike me, and again, I'm trying to draw on our experiences with the accounting policy information amendment that we did. So disclosure of material accounting policy information and the focus on items of information versus pieces of information rather than items themselves is the focus of the materiality assessment. I feel like it's worth an observation if others agree with this, and it is that the more troubled you are, the more information that's likely to be material. So I agree with the approach you've taken that we should have absolute requirements, but if the requirement is all material information, I think stuff that could be at the margins of is it material information, if you're ticking along pretty nicely, pretty stably, could become material information if you're further along the spectrum of trouble. And I don't want to write any new requirements, but I think thinking about that observation may be worthwhile. So that's a collection of tuning comments broadly in support of the proposals in the paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Nick?
Thanks, Hans. We've heard lots of useful, detailed comments on this paper, but I just want to step back and both in terms of the proposals we have here on priority on liquidation and also in terms of conditions, really, to, I think we've made some great progress in these papers. We struggled for some time to find a proportionate approach that provides useful information to investors, but at the same time avoids any sense of a potential disclosure overload, and I really think we're heading in the right direction, which with the papers we have here. I particularly like in this paper, paragraph 21, that seeks to tie back the information provided in the notes to the balance sheet. I think that'd be very useful. One area of detail for me, just following up on the discussion around capital structure, I think it's worth probably thinking about the illustrative example in IS1, which refers to capital structure, and also to coordinate with the staff on the management commentary practice statement, where I suspect there will also be some references to capital structure in their forthcoming ED, just to make sure we've got a holistic view there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Nick. Martin.
Yeah, thanks, Hansman. I also agree with the direction of where the staff is proposing to go in, but I have one concern, because if we speak also in the earlier paper and now insist about terms and conditions, and here that indicate priority and could change priority and including significant uncertainties, application of laws, blah, blah, blah. Isn't that really, I have not any idea for kind of a big bang. What does it mean? Is it then disclosure of 2 pages or is it 500 pages? I would fear it is 500 pages. And then the question is, how useful is that kind of information? So my question is, has the staff tested this kind of disclosure for a big financial institution? Because I have also seen some prospectus that banks have to describe terms and conditions of debt instruments, which are complicated. I think there are pages and pages and pages. And then the question is, okay, what is this kind of disclosure? Is it only saying, okay, that there is some terms and conditions could change priority, or to say what are the terms and conditions? My understanding of these papers is that the disclosure requirements is this terms and conditions has to be in the notes. And that is what I feel a little bit concerned. Is it really doable, and is it really not ending in a disclosure overload? So my question to the staff is maybe to have a test run with one of look at what I was compare with one of the big banks and say, okay, would that result in 100 pages of disclosure, or could it be done that it is really the users can really use it? Is it kind of an, because when if you look at prospectus of financial instruments, there are some instrument that is 100 pages in the prospectus. So that is my question.
Uni, would you like to give a preliminary answer to this or question?
Yeah, sure. Yes. Looking at even large banks, because the way we are proposing the disclosure is to for companies to describe the priority of a particular category of instruments and what it ranks ahead and what it ranks junior to. So we do think it could be made in a fairly in a way that doesn't take up many pages. I think it would be much shorter than that, and that's why. And it's also that because of that reason we are asking companies to disclose if there are multiple levels within a category, depending on how you aggregated the financial instrument. If there are multiple levels of subordination, state that there are multiple levels of subordination rather than requiring companies to analyze relative rankings within that category. So that's why we have made those suggestions to address the disclosure overload concern.
Mary, you want to
maybe
jump?
Because my understanding is, okay, that we're doing this kind of capital structure, and then we say, okay, that is subordinated debt or whatever. But what you require regarding prioritization is, at least my understanding from the papers, is to disclose the terms and conditions of this priority. Or I'm wrong. And that is my
concern. That's right.
It's not, and that's okay. But you
but
say,
it's not,
okay.
But it's not all the terms and conditions of the instrument.
No, which belongs to priority, which belongs to features, which could be then decide on equity and liability regarding to the first paper, but all these conditions relating to this judgment, then what you think, and okay. Good.
Okay.
And I think it would be a massive disclosure, but maybe I'm wrong.
Hopefully you're wrong. Bruce.
Thank you. Hans, I'll echo your comment. Hopefully you're wrong. I mean, I always have a concern around disclosure overload on any of these things, but I think we've made that. I just had two comments on the wording, well, what we'd suggested in the staff recommendation in paragraph 49. The first one was in B1. We talk about including whether there's significant uncertainties about the application of relative laws or regulations that could affect how priority on liquidation goes. Are we saying there the application of laws in that applicable to the financial instruments or applicable generally? So, for example, if I know that in a certain country, for example, tax always overrides anything else on liquidation, would I have to make a general comment around anything I believe would anything in the relevant laws or regulations are impacted, or is it just the FI? So it is a clarification on how broad that part was. The second one was just the only other concern I had was around point three there. We talk about the intergroup arrangements such as guarantees, etc. I know we did have this discussion when we last discussed it, and I guess my only comment around that one just gets into that whole element of once we start getting to the group disclosures, it's the fact that, as we know, failures don't always happen at the same time or cascade in the way we want them to. And I'd just be a little bit worried there that if I took a look at that, the permutations could result in me having to do quite a lot of disclosures. And the comment made earlier, I think, Mary, you made it, was around the more in trouble you get, the more those permutations could increase, which means if I'm not in a little bit of trouble or people within my group are in trouble, the disclosures I could have to get under there, given the various permutations, could be quite high. So once again, I think I agree with the direction we're going with these. Now, I like where it's going. I just kind of the devil's getting into the detail now. I don't want to end up in a situation where we start requiring people to do too much, or the level of disclosure when things get wrong or potentially could get wrong just kind of overloads it, and we lose all the real relevant stuff. Thank you.
Sue?
Yuni, I'm going to be nervous about voting in support of this when I don't really understand what we mean by capital structure. And a few people have made references to where we use capital structure elsewhere. In IAS1, I think we talk about capital, but all the basis and everything's all about regulated capital. So that's a very narrow view of capital. And in management commentary, we talk about capital structure in very generic terms. What are we thinking capital structure means here?
So it includes all instruments, all debt instruments and equity instruments that is used to fund the business activities and operation. And we think it will, the consideration of the instrument that arise from financing activities in IAS 7 would be relevant, but we don't think it will be limited to those instruments only. So as you raised as earlier as an example, supplier chain financing, even if that might be sitting outside the financing activities as defined by IAS 7, if it's used to fund the business and operation of the entity, we think that should be part of the capital structure of the entity.
Does that satisfy you?
So we're going to ask people to decide what they consider funds their operation.
Yes.
Is it?
Tom?
Yeah, if I could just do a quick follow-up, because I'd looked at 49A1 and it struck me that there is kind of an implicit definition when you say used to fund finance, it's overall business activities and operations. And with respect to the supply chain, I agree with Yuni's answer, but it struck me that a lot of entities would simply say this is a substitution for trade payables, and therefore it is not overall. And so if that definition allows a lot of latitude for people to do what I just said, is that an adequate definition, I guess would be my question? Or do we want them erring on the side of including supply chain when there's any doubt at all that it's overall? Because I think a lot of people could say it's basically a substitution for trade payables and leave it out.
just given, maybe you can go before I give my view.
Avriana, you go first.
Well, I was just going to make a suggestion that given the discussion we've had and, you know, some of the lack of understanding of exactly what we mean and what capital structure mean, because another way to look at capital structure might just be to say it's all your financial instruments, no matter where they sit or whatever it is, it's all the issued financial instruments. So it excludes IS 37 liabilities, for example, but it's, you know, everything you've issued. But I wonder whether it would make more sense to maybe not vote on this paper today, but for us to go away and you know, look at all the comments you've made and all the questions you've asked and see if we could address those and then bring it back for a vote at a later date. Because I'm just, you know, I don't think it's necessarily fair to ask you to vote on something if you're not sure what you're voting on. So that was going to be my suggestion.
I think that is an excellent idea, which means that we will not vote and wait for a follow-up document, which hopefully should not take you too much time,
yeah,
given that you have thoughts about how to address these questions.
Yeah.
Okay, then let's move over to what I think is the final paper.
Yeah, so good morning, everyone. In Agenda Paper 5C, the staff set out further refinements to the proposals for disclosures on potential dilution of ordinary shares. And the objective of these disclosures is to enable existing and potential investors to assess the potential dilution arising from financial instruments issued at the reporting date that could be settled by delivering ordinary shares. So at the February board meeting, feedback from board members was largely supportive. However, based on stakeholder feedback about including potential dilution from IFRS 2 share-based payment transactions in the maximum dilution number and requests for additional explanations about the maximum dilution calculation, we addressed these issues at this meeting. So firstly, to consider incorporating IFRS 2 instruments and transactions, we relooked at some of the requirements in IFRS 2 and IS 33 and the assumptions that were proposed in the maximum dilution calculation for non-IFRS 2 instruments, which were also discussed in February. And our findings are presented in paragraphs 9 to 19 of the paper. We specifically want to highlight that based on our understanding of the IFRS 2 disclosure requirements, there is an explicit requirement to disclose the number of share options outstanding at the end of the reporting period, but not the number of unvested shares, for example, from deferred share awards. And there's also no specific mention of disclosure requirements if the number of unvested shares or shares to be purchased by counterparties is not known at the reporting date. So with that understanding, we then set out six alternative approaches for incorporating the dilutive impact from IFRS 2 instruments and transactions in the proposed disclosures, and those are discussed in paragraphs 20 to 28 of the paper. The staff's preference is for alternative B2. And just to recap very briefly, alternative A does not include IFRS 2 instruments and transactions in the calculation of the maximum dilution number. So entities would need to cross-refer to existing IFRS 2 disclosures. And alternative C to E would require additional assumptions and estimates to calculate the number of unvested shares and shares to be purchased. And this could include added complexity. Alternative B involves a compromise because some IFRS 2 transactions and instruments would be included in the maximum dilution calculation, with alternative B2, which is our preference, incorporating the no number of unvested shares. So in paragraphs 33 to 54 of the paper, the staff then provide information on how to calculate the maximum dilution number, including a simple set of assumptions, illustrative examples, and illustrative disclosure. And in paragraph 34, we also set out an underlying principle for entities to determine the maximum dilution number, which is to assume the maximum possible increase and the minimum reduction in the number of shares. And finally, in paragraph 55 to 56 of the paper, we summarize our recommended disclosures to be incorporated in IFRS 7. And with that, I'll now turn over the discussion to board members before asking the board whether it agrees with the staff's recommendations.
Nick.
Thank you, Hans. So, first of all, I mean, I like where we're going with this overall. I agree with your observation that the maximum dilution disclosures are don't replace the diluted earnings per share calculations. And although they build on those calculations, they are different in nature. They're trying to achieve a different end. Clearly, by building on those diluted earnings per share disclosures, they take out some of the cost issues that could be concerned for preparers here. I very much welcome that we're extending the proposals to the IFRS 2 considerations. I think one of the frustrations that users have with IFRS 2 today, for instance, is as though it asks for the number of outstanding options related to each scheme. There's no aggregation of that number even within IFRS 2. And that doesn't seem to fit into a world of digital consumption of financial information. So to be able to come up with a metric that represents the maximum potential diluted number of shares, I think would be very helpful. One minor point of clarification that I think would be useful or to think about further would be exactly what we mean by committed buybacks. I think we need to be clear what we mean by that. There's a difference between management standing up and saying they're committed to a buyback program and a program which has also been authorized by shareholders. And my sense is that we would need quite a high bar there in terms of what a committed buyback program means. So I think we need to probably flesh that out a little bit more. The one thing that I think is important is to think about how this information will be used. People will take it to be the maximum possible number of shares that can be issued, the maximum level of dilution. And my sense is that they will use it as a screening tool. So if I run down a list of potential entities that I consider as investment opportunities, if that number comes out at 2%, I'm going to say, right, that's fine. That's within my tolerance. If it comes out at 7, 8 or 9%, I'm going to say, actually, here I need to do some more work. I need to understand how likely it is that some of those, let's say, options are going to come into the money. What's the likelihood of that being 9%? Well, some of them so far out of the money, I don't need to worry about it any further. So I think when we come down to the issue of the unvested shares, where potentially the number isn't known, we do have an issue there around faithful representation in terms of how this number will be interpreted. And I know we're suggesting in some of the alternatives that we would have a number that excluded uninvested shares where the number's not known. I'll come back to that in a moment. And that we'd have some narrative disclosure around that. But my worry is as people use this data, they will see that the number is, let's say, 2%, and they'll take that as given, and they won't go to the narrative disclosure because they won't feel there's a need to do further work. So I actually would favor a variation. I think it's on alternative E. It's alternative E with a modification. And if I look at the examples you have where there are unvested shares, where the number's not known, if you look at the mechanics of what you set out in terms of how that equation works, I can't contend that the number isn't known. But often behind the scenes in those scheme particulars that support those particular schemes for staff often to buy shares, there will be a maximum stated in those scheme particulars. So there is actually a maximum. Now, if that isn't stated in those scheme particulars, if we can't get a maximum, the answer is that actually the number of shares that's unknown is unlimited. If it's not constrained in any way, it's an unlimited number of shares that could be issued. And I think that would be very important information to know as a shareholder. It may only come about in exceptional circumstances that a very high number of shares are issued, but it could happen. So my preference would be to go along the lines that you have suggested, but to deal with uninvested shares where the number seemingly isn't known by either going to the scheme documents to say, actually, is there a cap within that document? And if there isn't a cap, instead of listing a number as the disclosure, the number would be, or the disclosure item would be, actually, it's unlimited. And I suspect actually in the fullness of time that would change behaviors if that was the case. I suspect it's actually very rare that that would be the case also. But clearly, I think it would be entirely right for investors to know that the number is unlimited. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Nick. Mary?
I want to sign up to strong support for, I think, all of the comments Nick made, including that, as the staff has said, that these disclosures supplement rather than duplicate the diluted earnings per share, and therefore I think we should be pursuing them, and that we take an approach, you know, Angie, you looked at A through E, of bringing in at least a good chunk, what we expect would be a good chunk of the IFRS 2 items into the single disclosure of maximum dilution. And my slight variance from Nick is that rather than suggesting going another route, because like him, I first thought, oh, there are some easier answers on some of the unvested share, you know, issues that you identified. But I think on balance, the benefit of having a clean cut at a certain point, in terms of the understandability, avoiding complexity, probably outweighs being able to specify reasonably simple approaches for most, but not all, of the ones that get picked up by C, D, and E. But taking Nick's point, and I hadn't thought enough about digital consumption of the information, would it, you know, it's partly a question to Nick, but also to the team to think about. Should we be saying that if you have one or more items, you know, if you have at least one item that it for which the thing is unknown, you cannot present a total maximum dilution? Be, you know, it, and the point is, I think I would still, Nick, want to have a table that shows the maximum for those instruments for which we know the maximum. But I think what I want in a digital consumption of that information is to go to the atom that's tagged total maximum dilution and find, you know, the error message that says cannot be computed, because that flags for me that I have to go and read the qualitative information. And I think I'd prefer that combined with the streamlined version that the staff is supporting in B2, I think it is, rather than trying to give workarounds for those. I mean, I might explore the point you made about saying you're allowed but not required to substitute the maximum permitted by the plan. But I think I would stick with a simpler cut rather than going to E and varying how, you know, approach E and varying how we did approach E. And I think it's a question for those who think more about digital consumption of the data, whether saying specifically you can't strike a total if you don't know all the items would be enough. In terms of a couple of other things that I noticed, in paragraph 3, you talk about I thought it was paragraph 3, where you talk about ordinary shares, and I think we have to be clear that it's all classes of ordinary shares, because entities may have classes that differ, and they may differ only in voting rights. But I think we want to make clear, I'm assuming that we want all ordinary shares rather than just identifying a single class that you talk about. And so while when we were talking in the terms and conditions paper about focusing on voting rights that are linked to cash flow triggers, I think we may be thinking more broadly about voting rights here in a couple, or if we're not, we should be in a couple of places, so that the paragraph 3 ordinary shares refers to all ordinary shares. And even if the, you know, the difference is in voting rights. And I think that there may be a couple of other places where we want some information about voting rights. And then my biggest point, though, I think, and this echoes something else that Nick was saying, is I was uncomfortable with how far we were going in terms of what's permitted slash required to be included for the buybacks, in part because I didn't necessarily agree with it's necessary because it's all really part of a single transaction. If a very typical buyback program is that it's linked to a share-based payment program, and the buyback is a capital market transaction, and the share-based payment is with employees, so you have different counterparties. I don't want to start implying that we would synthetically integrate those into a single transaction. I have no problems with disclosure that says that the company seeks to manage the dilution effect of, you know, whatever instruments it is, share-based payment or other, and therefore has in place a buyback program. But I, like Nick, I have skepticism about the degree to which the entity is pre-committed to make purchases under those plans. I think they have targets. I think they have authorizations. But if the instrument you're using is a purchase call, you are not required to exercise that. And it's going to come down to cash on the day, insider trading regulations that may block you out from buying on certain dates, et cetera, that says to me that the range of actually committed to buy is very narrow. We can let people disclose whatever they want about their intentions, their programs, et cetera. But I think we should have a very, very narrow definition of what goes into that committed buyback number in the maximum dilution disclosure, because after all, the purpose is to show maximum dilution. And so therefore, I'm not supportive of the staff's proposed approach in that one area of this paper. Thank you.
Nick, I understand you want to react to Mary.
Thanks, Mary, for the suggestion. I think, just to be clear, I think what you're suggesting is that rather than having, let me call them data items, one data item, there would be two. So one would be, as the staff propose in alternative B2, which would have known amounts, and the second one would include the maximum, including any unknown amounts. And clearly, where there aren't unknown amounts, those numbers would be exactly the same for entities. And if there was an unknown amount, I think you used the word error. I would use the word unlimited. I still think, from my view, I think it's still simpler to combine that into one data item and would avoid any danger of misinterpretation in terms of investors. And actually, it's better if you had a single data item and it comes up as error, that can then be supplemented by narrative disclosure to explain, right, rather than the other way around. Just the investor sees just the known items, thinks I've taken my download about maximum, it's fine. I just think to me there's some risk in that.
Hans, just coming back in, Nick, what I was saying is, I think, thinking ahead to the taxonomy structure first, I think I would say two pieces of data required. One is total maximum dilution, and the second is information for each instrument about the maximum dilution for that instrument. You always provide the second type of data. It's either known and provided or unknown. If you have any unknowns, then the first piece of data is not available, or C-qualitative, or something that says you're not allowed to strike a total if you have an unknown component. But that way, if somebody is trying to go and pick up the data that is tagged maximum dilution, somebody would be, and when I said error, I was thinking of Excel spreadsheets where it says invalid input kind of error. You know, it's just saying that you can't strike a total because you have an unknown item. That's what I was trying to get to.
I think that puts us more on the same page then. Thank you.
Angie?
Yeah, can I just clarify? So would it work if we kept with B2 and then for those items where you, like in Nick's comments, where we do know that there's like another description of the maximum for these share purchase plans, so that would be clarified as something that's known. But then for those where there's no such description of a maximum, you would include it in the table, but have and like just a description that says unknown dilution. So it wouldn't, you wouldn't have to worry about getting to a subtotal with like an error message or you or flagged like to a footnote, because it's actually in the table already, just that it has this unknown dilution, which is similar to what we were suggesting when it comes to, say, unlisted shares. If you can't determine the share price, you'd also put that there's unknown dilution. And I'm using the word unknown rather than unlimited, because I think I'm not 100% sure if anything's completely unlimited, but just to flag to users that there is some uncertainty and this number is unknown. Would that work? So it would still be B2, but then we can just add a refinement.
I see, it
would certainly be a flag for someone to go and do more work rather than take some misinformation in terms of a number which would be lower than what it could be. So it could work, yes.
Okay, and then I just want... Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. I just wanted to confirm with Mary, when you were disagreeing about the buybacks, was that only for those where we're talking about the economic hedging transactions that we were proposing that you would take into account, for example, purchase call options? Or was it in general the idea of reducing the dilution with a minimum number? Because some of the committed programs, there could be a range where they say that this is a minimum number that they would go and buy back in the market. So we would want to reduce it if there was a committed program, like it's certain, or if there's a forward contract. But in other cases, when there's only a call option, we would exclude it unless there's like a specific link that you can say this is part of some economic hedging transaction.
I do not object fundamentally to having information about minimum buybacks. I think we should have a very high hurdle, and basically where the entity is committed, and by committed I don't mean intent and has a program, but it still has to execute. I'd agree with forwards, but I think we should focus on the objective being maximum dilution. I take the point that there's useful information in understanding buybacks. It feels to me that it should be subject to a very, very high hurdle. So it really came out in your discussion of, what did you call it? Economic hedging. But I don't see why I'd say it's bad in that context, but it's okay elsewhere. I think we just have to have a single understandable, very high threshold for when you get picked up in the offset to the maximum dilution.
Okay. That deal then.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with the staff's recommendation in paragraph 55 and 56, especially in relation to the interaction with the proposed requirements in the current disclosures in IFRS 2. I personally like alternative A, simply cross-reference, thinking about the instruments we are aiming in this project as a whole. Of course, subject to confirmation that might be wrong, the impact of dilutions caused by instruments in the scope of IFRS 2. I think that they are likely not material for the matter we are discussing, but of course it could be. And then in this regard, I think that the staff's proposal would cover this potential impact. But I still, again, think that what is being proposed as in general is quite helpful to avoid much complexity and therefore cause for to prepare. And at the same time, I do not see that we are losing useful information with with the simplification. I think the proposal focuses on where we believe the understanding of the potential dilution is more relevant. But finally, in listening to all the discussion we just had, I know it's out of the scope of the project, but based on some of the comments included in the paper and then some board members mentioned, I'm wondering whether there is room to have a look on the current IFRS 2 disclosure requirement as a consequence of this project. But I think that they are two different stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Rika?
Thank you, Hans. I actually don't support the recommendation on alternative B2. My preference is probably alternative A, and maybe I can accept the B1. Because I think how the practice of applying the existing IFRS 2 is evolved, and also the established disclosure practice of IFRS 2 don't support the user's proper understanding of the potential numbers of shares or share option before vested, especially from the perspective of the existing IFRS 2, the disclosure focus on the expense already recognized and to be recognized probably in terms of stock compensation arrangement or scheme, and also the related management judgment in case of uncertainty in that context. So the focus of disclosure is underlining conditions, vesting conditions that affect the estimate of the expense rather than the less realized scenario of vesting condition. And another thing is, in practice, some typical scheme of stock compensation have a wide range of multiple target with other complicated conditions within just 1 hour. And the targets of vesting conditions at high end can provide a larger number of shares or share option. So that will be included in this disclosure in the end of the day. But the likelihood of meeting such target is really extremely low. So I think if we decide to take the alternative B2, as staff recommended, the improvement in the IFRS 2 disclosure requirement is really necessary to support investors' understanding of the further those numbers mean, those numeric information means. But I think it's really beyond the scope of this project. So I really don't support alternative B2 and C beyond, going beyond. And another thing I want to mention, maybe I should have mentioned this point on the other paper, the previous paper we discussed, but I think information related to capital structure, stock, stock option is generally considered material quantitatively, even though it's not material quantitatively. So I think we need to be very careful about what the scope should be set and what type of the information we are going to ask the entity to disclose, because maybe the materiality that we consider might not be effectively worked in the practice as we wish. Thank you, Hans.
Thank you, Rika. Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Just two comments. I think in terms of you know, the scope issue in relation to the IFRS 2, I agree with staff's proposal. I think it's consistent with the objective of maximum, you know, dilution calculation. And so it's therefore including those numbers of share options outstanding and the number of unvested shares known. I think it's consistent with the objective and also consistent with other options or other, you know, derivatives embedded in those financial instruments. If we look at the examples given, the paragraph, you know, I think from starting from 41, I think generally, I think the principle is consistent. So I agree. This is the practical solution to calculate the maximum, you know, dilution of the ordinary shared shares. Second comments on how to calculate the number of ordinary shares, or maybe committed, or you know, required to be purchased. That is related to buyback scheme or something like that. I think Mary and Nick also commented. I have similar concern because first, what's the criteria? I think it's not very clear. For example, the terminology we are using, I think paragraph 36, we use those, you know, ordinary shares committed to be repurchased. And paragraph 37, we introduce another term that's contractually committed. And the wording included in the staff recommendation in paragraph 55, 5B, we use the wording, paragraph 55A, 2, we use the wording required to be repurchased. I think we should use the same wording. And the second, Mary said higher hurdle, or Nick said high bar. I think what's the meaning of committed if we are using the same wording, and to clarify, because this is really important notion to help people, to help prepare what kind of number should be detected from the maximum dilution calculation. And the second point in relation to this point, this calculation, I think in reality, there may be two scenarios. One scenario is that there is a range of the ordinary shares maybe the company committed to repurchase. In this scenario, I think address the minimum number of the ordinary shares, it's fine. Maybe in some financial instruments or some buybacks scheme, maybe primarily, you know, there is a fixed number has been determined in advance. So in this regard, I think that fixed number could be directly used for the purpose of maximum dilution, you know, calculation. So I think this kind of notion scenario also could be addressed. But generally, basically, I agree that number should be detected from maximum dilution calculation. But just simply with regards to the wording and clarification needed. Thank you.
Sue.
Thanks. A couple of comments. Firstly, I like the direction that this is going in. Angie, good job. In terms of the interaction with IFRS 2, I was comfortable with the B2 recommendation, but I think the tweak that you discussed following on Nick and Mary's comments is probably an enhancement, so I'd support B2 with that enhancement. Just one observation on the maximum dilution analysis. I think what's great about the maximum dilution analysis is its simplicity. I mean, it's a very blunt tool. It's just a very simple way of saying, you know, be aware there's this potential maximum dilution, and that's what's fantastic about it. What's the risk it brings with it, though, is that it doesn't differentiate between dilution that's really, really likely to happen tomorrow and something that's really super unlikely to happen. And so it's sort of a little bit of, you know, you have to be a little bit careful with how you use the information. And certainly when I talked to a couple of investors when we had the DP out, the thing they said they would do with this is, I think, similar to what Nick was alluding to. They'll scan down and they'll make their own assessment on which dilution they think is likely to happen or not, and therefore how worried they are. So I think it's going to be particularly important that we've got the right terms and conditions in the information that facilitates that assessment, so that people, you know, get the right idea of the likelihood of the dilution occurring without the complexity of a calculation. So I just think we need to be careful with our messaging, because paragraph 39, I would have read as saying, you know, contingency is something we might want information about, but strike prices and things are probably a step too far. I think we need to be careful with our messaging, because I think you may well need to understand, you know, strike prices to know how in and out of the money you are. So I think that getting enough information to really put the risk of dilution into context will be important. The last comment I wanted to make was on this whole thing about the mitigants to dilution, if you like. So for me, the most important thing is that in the first instance, we get to a maximum dilution total, which isn't muddied at all by any of these assessments of, you know, I'm committed to buyback or anything like that. So being abundantly clear that, first of all, there's this subtotal at least that's just the maximum dilution, and that, you know, we're not asking management to talk about mitigation. But I think in keeping with the great thing about the maximum dilution being so simple, I'm nervous that the mitigants will start to get complicated. And, you know, this used to be the, I used to be an equity derivative structurer. So this is the stuff I used to work on. So it gets pretty complicated, and I think there'll be really hard judgments to make. And companies are going to be incentivized to give information about the mitigants, because they're not going to want people to over-focus on maximum dilution if they've got stuff in place to mitigate that, because they know people don't like dilution. So given that they're going to be incentivized to provide good information, I wonder whether we're better to focus on a table that's very, you know, detailed about how you do the maximum dilution, and then have a more generic, if you've got mitigating arrangements in place or something like that, that would, you know, have an effect on this dilution outcome or something, please provide information to enable investors to understand, and make something more generic. I wonder whether that's a better approach, because otherwise we're going to have to start getting quite detailed about what's okay to include, what not, and it's going to get complicated. And this is a really basic, simple analysis, which is a good thing. So I wonder whether we really need to get into that detail.
Okay, thank you, Sue. Zach?
Just to build on what's already said, I love this because it's a great tool to identify tail risk. And I think that's its strength in what we're doing. So I would be supportive of the 2B, kind of as amended by discussions between Mary and Nick. I think those were great additions. Sort of conceptually, the way I think of it is, here are the items we know where we can calculate the maximum dilution, and here are the items where we can't come to an exact estimate for these reasons. So the one thing I did want to highlight is I think there is one item in the draft as written where we quantified something that is unknowable. And that's in paragraph 38G, where we allowed a expedient where a company could use the current share price to estimate maximum dilution. That's sort of analogous to some of what we do in IFRS 2. And I think we should avoid that. If it's a variable number of shares being delivered, the correct answer for maximum dilution isn't today's shares price divided by whatever the numerator is, or flip that around, sorry. It's actually, we don't know, but here's how we're going to be able to project it. So in thinking of those two categories, I would not put that instrument in the known category where we can provide a solid estimate of the maximum dilution, but instead move it down into that unknown or unlimited category and say, here's how you can assess what you think the likelihood is. Because I think where you see company share prices react from dilution, those are in fact some of the very instruments, and you tend to see them in smaller companies rather than bigger, where you get into this share price death spiral for repeated dilution at constantly lowering prices. Because that's actually the mechanics of the value of the company. It goes down and down per share the more you dilute. So again, very supportive. I really like the amended version of 2B, but I think there's one tweak there in terms of the categories that I'd love to see.
Okay, thank you, Zach. Tom?
Yeah, so totally agree with what Zach just said. And again, I'll just highlight a couple of things. First of all, excellent paper. I really liked it. I like 2B as amended. I like Angie's description of where there's uncertainty, and Zach just emphasized this concept of uncertainty that could be used for the amended. 2B works in particular because it delivers in a single place a very useful number of maximum dilution that people can use. IFRS 2 is incomplete at present, and this avoids having to go and amend IFRS 2, which would be a much more complicated effort. And I think with respect to Sue's comment, I would expect people to use this information, and there's evidence empirically that they do, to help them understand the range. And when they see this number and they see the amended part that they can go and look, I think then they'll go and do things and they'll actually conduct the additional analysis. And this alerts them, but it also gives them, as Zach used, a nice quick signal about there's tail end risk. And sometimes that may be all that they need to proceed. So I really like where we are with B2 with the amendment.
Okay, finally, Bruce.
Thanks very much. I was just also going to give my support to the staff's direction. I mean, I think you can listen to the various arguments about how we would calculate it, but I think when I worked through it myself, I also thought B2 kind of got us to the closest to where the objective is. I mean, I think as long as we've got enough disclosure that people understand how we're getting to that figure, to be honest, if we settled somewhere else, I don't think it would be as good. But once again, as long as people understand what's going to the calculation, I'm happy with that. As far as the disclosures, I like the idea of cross-referencing, where we mentioned cross-references to IFRS 2. I appreciate, yes, maybe the disclosures aren't perfect, but I would worry that we'd start repeating things. So I think we do need to just be cognizant of what's in each. Interestingly, I had a comment that my concern was also about some of the mitigating factors. I really like the idea that Sue suggested, if I heard her right, kind of saying that it would actually be quite useful to almost see how you've got to the dilution and where you've got those mitigating factors kind of next to it. I know it sounds nice, simplistic. I like tables. It allows me to see exactly where we got to, what mitigations there may be around those. I think that would be quite useful disclosure. So something maybe the staff want to take a look at.
Okay. I think we're ready to vote. Obviously, some amendments have been proposed. I think we can take them, the staff will take those on board, and this is about the direction. So can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Sorry, 12.
Okay. All right. Does this bring us to the conclusion of our discussion? Rihanna nods. Okay, thank you very much. We made a lot of progress, and I conclude these deliberations. Thank you very much.